The magic of musical improv. How do they do it? How do they occupy the moment, moment by moment, to generate something new and sweet or savoury?
I think some of it's similar to what amazes us so much when we, for example, watch great athletes. We see someone doing something with a human body and a human brain that looks on the surface pretty much like our own, but doing something that maybe we could never imagine ourselves doing, and really pushing themselves to the limit of what's possible. I mean, if we imagine the improvising pianist, they're making decisions on the millisecond and millimeter level before our eyes, and somehow also making something that's exciting and beautiful and engaging.
Natasha Mitchell, joining you for All in the Mind on ABC Radio National. The thing is, we're all capable of creatively improvising. We just don't give ourselves the credit. The next sentence you say will almost certainly be improvised. Walking along a crowded street, a major physical improvisation many of us do every day. So what is it about musical improvisation that leaves us so awestruck? And what's going on in the minds of musical improvisers? What are they thinking about to do what they do? Or is there an element of suspending thought? My sometime musical colleague Corin Podger is taking us to meet two of Australia's finest and an improvising neuroscientist to help us find out. I played the piano since I was 8 years ago. I learned Bach's Toccata in D minor, and if you've heard it before, you'll recognise the opening notes. What I can't do, and what's always been utterly mystifying, is how someone like Argentinian improviser Gabriela Montero can take that Toccata and spontaneously, in the moment, turn it into this. Gabriela's making this up as she goes along. Bach's Toccata is obviously her jumping-off point, but none of what she's playing now was written down before she began. How's she doing this? Choosing moment to moment which keys to hit and which ones to avoid so that the end result is great music.
I think that there's a really different feel about the ideology of time passing when you're doing it for real. And it's like putty. And maybe you're going to pass it to somebody else in the room, or you're not. Maybe you're just going to pull it around for a bit. If you're really working with that, like holding a bubble, you're not quite sure in which direction it's going to go. And I'm hoping that they share the delight and the fantasy that I experience from doing this in real time, as opposed to having a composed bubble that I know I have to reproduce for an audience at a special time, because that's what Ros Bandt said she's doing on page 4. The rules of the game are not set. They're hardly even there in some instances in improvisation. So the wonder and your creativity with actually being able to push and pull and reform this sound and to give it a life force of its own in relation to all the other matter, it has to be the curiosity of what's happening in improvisation.
Experimental musician Ros Bandt, one of two phenomenal Australian teachers and performers of improvisation, who are letting us sit in on their performances to provide some insights. The other's Tony Gould. Both have spent more than 3 decades performing and teaching music in Australia and overseas. For Tony, improv occupies an intriguing musical and mental space between deliberate composition and random noise.
Several years ago at university, we tried to come up with a definition of music as distinct from noise. We decided that music was sounds organized by human beings. That doesn't quite cover the whole picture, but that's about as close as you can get. It's organized as distinct from random noise, industrial noise, for example. You get away from that to listen to music.
There's obviously two big things here, and one is freedom and the other one is control. So you might decide that you're going to do an improvised piece which is inspired by something. Or there might be a gap in a ready-made piece for the improvisation to occur, like in a cadenza or some kind of place where somebody takes their set for their freedom in that piece and then come back to the straight thing.
Does it have to do with intention?
I think it does. I think the amount of improvisation that occurs is also to do a lot with the ability of the performer to be comfortable with letting go the norms, and can be really coming from a completely broad canvas of nothing and making something from a speck.
Whether it's melodic, as we heard from Tony in his piece The Lucky Ones, or dissonant, like Ros Bandt's work Stack, improvisers walk a risky line between control and doing as they please. To avoid everything going horribly wrong, as Tony puts it, there's a lot a musician needs to internalise first, as Ros explains.
It's really essential to get your hands on to sound as a canvas. Every sound has its life cycle of itself with all of these criteria, you know, pitch, dynamics, timbre, the shape of its beginning and end, its formant, its little harmonic spectrum. And if you have a look at it on an oscilloscope, that's really a lot of fun for people who don't know anything about music to have a look at the kind of sound picture that they're making. If they're looking at square waves when they're going, or it's something melodious like flute sound, and they're getting this beautiful ripple. So I try to find set up a marvellous environment that's very free and playful, where people can learn so much about playing with the field of sound. And then also learning to collaborate with other people and their ideas, because if you're going to be in an improvising band, you can't just be like a straight violinist that's going to play concertos. It doesn't work like that. You have to have a whole range of different skills.
You have to be free, a free spirit to start. To lose your inhibitions. It's a dangerous business. A few things can go wrong. Sit at the keyboard, see what sound you make. See what you can make sound appealing to you and then to other people, hopefully. I'm constantly suggesting two things to my improvising students. Get some classical lessons to make sure your skill level is high, and then develop the idea of going to the keyboard. In everyone's practice regime as an improviser, you need a half an hour of I don't care what it sounds like, I'm just going to see what happens. But also to spend a lot of time listening to music. I think that's the best teaching you can learn.
Do you think that the way that somebody is introduced to music, generally speaking, determines their ability as an improviser or as a potential improviser? For example, I learned to play piano from sheet music. If I don't have a piece of music in front of me, I can't play a note.
Could I say that's very sad? In a way.
But does it imply that some people are easier to teach improvisation than others, depending upon how they've come to learn music in the first place?
Look, I think that's true. For example, in my experience with classical musicians that want to learn to improvise, there's an inhibition there that comes from, I can't possibly play anything without seeing the printed page. That's what I mean about it. It's a kind of sad thing. And I'll just play me anything, you know, just play anything. But they're reluctant to do that because it mightn't be any good.
Some personalities are going to adapt easily than the others. A lot of people are scared of the unknown. When I made my sound playground in 1981 in the park in Brunswick, I made a big sculpture so that everybody could play with sound and improvise and see if they could. How do you know if you've never done it before? And suddenly you find people from the community jamming together. The better the skills that you have, the more you can bring to the free situation. And yes, I do think everybody is capable of it.
Music history and geography back that up. Before the recording industry helped drive a fashion for music that sounds the same every time it's played, the hallmark of great musicians and composers was the ability to just sit down and make stuff up. And it's still a thriving part of the music scene in many cultures.
Most of the great composers we think of, Bach, Beethoven, Mozart, Chopin, they were all great improvisers. We remember them for their compositions, but sometime around the turn of the 19th century into the 20th century, the classical performer became more interested in pre-composed repertoire by other composers, as opposed to improvising their own music and composing their own music. And that split is less present in jazz and Indian classical music and a lot of the world's traditions where to play music means to be able to improvise.
Harvard University neuroscientist and concert pianist, Dr. Aaron Berkowitz. His PhD explored both the history of improv and its neurological basis. His research builds on work already done on music and language, a form of improvisation we all do, all the time.
A lot of the work had looked at the similarities and differences between how people perceive music and language and how the sound systems are organized, but not so much work had been done on the sort of production aspect. So when we're speaking, that's a pretty marvelous talent that we have to learn a language, first of all, and then be able to speak in real time without having to think of the rules or so much about what we're going to say next. We can just kind of do it and someone else will understand. And the closest correlate I thought about in music to that is improvisation, where similarly an improviser, a jazz improviser, for example, could sit down and improvise the blues and we would hear it as the blues, and yet it would be something they've never played before and something we've never heard before.
Now, we do all use, as you say, improvisation every day. For example, mm-hmm. when I'm speaking and forming this sentence, I'm picking words, and right. I could pick other words, obviously. Why is there a temptation to see musical improvisation as something so particularly special?
I think that's a great question. Some people have defined creativity as creating something that's both new and valuable. And some psychologists of creativity have made a distinction between what they call little c creativity and capital C creativity, which sort of draws this distinction between our everyday creativity of speaking or balancing two bags of groceries while we pull the keys out of our pocket and open the door without dropping anything. And then sort of the big C creativity, people would say, happens in scientific discovery or in music or in art. Thinking about musical improvisation, what makes it so exciting, I think, to observe is it's almost like if we could watch the painter painting the painting. We don't just see the final result. We don't just hear the Beethoven symphony or see the wonderful Monet. We actually are with the artist as they're creating in real time, sort of before our ears, before our eyes. And something, when we see and hear great improvised music, we feel we're really a part of something that's never happened before and something that's never going to happen again, perhaps.
Aaron, you very kindly shared one of your own performances with us. Mm-hmm. Tony said he saw the birds flying. There are sections of this composition that are improvised by yourself. Tell me a little bit about it and how you thought about that as you were doing it.
I was at the piano sort of improvising and came up with some ideas, and sometimes I'd find something I liked and I'd sort of write down a little mnemonic for remembering what it was, or maybe a drawing that sort of represented what it looked like. And then gradually it sort of developed itself into a piece.
Aaron Berkowitz here on All in the Mind on Radio National and Radio Australia and online. I'm Corinne Podger. Aaron turned his PhD into a book, The Improvising Mind. It's a wonderful romp through the history and geography of improv, from German Baroque to American jazz, Indian ragas to Persian dastak. And he found strong similarities between learning to improvise and learning language.
The commonality there is a lot of them say, I was never taught specifically to improvise. They were sort of taught a musical system. So someone like Robert Levin, one of his specialties is improvising the style of Mozart, probably played almost every piece of Mozart there is on the piano at some point. He never set out to learn to improvise. He set out to learn all of this music. Then at a certain point, he decided he would like to improvise. And he started to sort of practice, well, what happens when I do this? What if I start with this Mozart melody? And how do I think he would develop it? What harmonies would he use? Across cultures, people describe something similar, and ethnomusicologists that have interviewed musicians across cultures come up with a similar answer, that people aren't taught explicitly to improvise. They should have taught a musical system. They do a lot of playing, they do a lot of practicing, they do a lot of listening, and over time they've internalized the system to a point where they can move within it spontaneously. Just as when we're children, no one teaches us how to speak our first language. And improvisation is similar. Musicians I spoke to spend a lot of time practicing fixed musical elements. The jazz musicians learn the jazz standards, the solos of the great masters, they transcribe them out, they practice them, and eventually the amount of knowledge they have becomes so large and so interconnected with different possibilities they've combined that they can go out on stage and make something new out of all that.
To get to a point where you have automaticity with all of those skills, what's involved there? You've talked, for example, about utilizing cognitive economy, for example. Mm. What's that?
This idea of cognitive economy comes from the idea of the psychology of concept learning. This is very evolutionarily useful. Imagine if every time we saw a tomato, we had to sit there and say, well, it's red and it's round and has those little green leaves at the top. I think I've seen this before. What is it? Is it safe to eat? It's much more efficient if the brain can say, well, anything that looks basically like this and fits into these parameters, I can make the category tomato. And so I tried to think about that idea in improvisation. Again, if we imagine the improviser, let's take jazz again for an example. This improviser is learning, for example, the chords in the blues. They learn to play the blues in a bunch of different keys, but underlying that is the blues. It's a set of the same sort of underlying chords in the same underlying sequence. If each of those had to be a separate representation in the brain, that would take up a lot of space, if you will, and time to think about. But by just internalizing this idea of blues, and being able to manifest it in a number of different keys. We have that sort of underlying economy.
You've also identified different types of memory that musicians mm-hmm. need to build up and draw on during improvisation. There's yeah. implicit and explicit memory, for example.
So the idea with implicit and explicit memory is sort of how conscious the memory is. So there are things that we can explicitly recall, and there are things that are more implicit. We sort of are aware of them without necessarily having explicit or sort of knowledge that we can articulate. For example, if we think about we know how to ride a bicycle, it's hard to articulate that knowledge. How does one actually balance when riding a bike? Can one really describe how one is keeping one's body in space and pedaling and doing all those things? If you thought about it too much, you might
fall off
the bike. Exactly. And improvisers sort of describe something similar. So, for example, let's take our jazz musician again. They might explicitly say, as I said, I want to learn this riff by Coltrane, or I want to learn the blues. And yet we know when we hear great musicians play the blues that there's a certain feel to the blues, and there's a certain swing to the blues. There's a certain blueness to certain notes. Can they really tell us how they're doing that, or is it something that over time they've sort of developed a feel for?
But what about the moment-to-moment decisions involved in improvisation? Here's Tony Gould talking us through the process for him. What goes through your mind as you're thinking about where this piece will go?
Great but complicated question. Let's think of something in play that's fairly well known. Here's a jazz standard called You Don't Know What Love Is, and a lot of people still play this. There's another new chord coming here, and it's generally this one. It's generally that one. So I mightn't choose to do that. I might colour the inside of it. I might do that and live with it, you know, if I muck it up. So you're sort of making decisions all the time depending on the level of creativity, what mode of creativity you're in. So I might take more chances. So here's the start again. What note am I going to choose next? These. And I think I'll play this time. And this one. And this is not written into the sheet music. I might like to stop there for a while. This is sort of Debussy-like. I changed the chord of that. The first time I played it, I didn't put that note in. But I've deliberately done that because I don't want to do the same thing twice. So that's one sound, and this is another one.
Is it completely random as you're going along?
It's where I don't think it's completely random. I actually am not too sure about is anything really spontaneous besides hitting yourself on the knee and giving you that knee-jerk reaction. There is spontaneity, but it's not split-second spontaneity. I was just talking to a student about this morning. I said, this is the progression. That's the piece too. And I said to him, if you don't compose at least that much before you start, you will island hop from one chord to the next. And he did it, and he played something like... I thought, did you compose it before you start? I said, yes. So the next phrase goes... So I said, see if you can think of a connection. So he played...
Are you hearing where you're going as
yes.
you're going along?
Yes. If you don't do that, you are going along in bumps across the bar line.
Even in free improvisation, yeah. You're hearing where you're going even in those circumstances?
Not entirely, I have to admit. That mindset is totally different. I'm really interested in sounds, like that one I played before. That's just a spontaneous... Well, it's not spontaneous anymore as I did before. But so if I'm doing that sort of thing, I might do something like this. That's totally spontaneous. Except I've got my hands in a position on the keyboard where I know it's going to be dissonant. But everybody can do that. But can you make a piece of music out of it? And that depends on two things. How long it's going to go before it falls in a heap, and whether you have some grasp of structure and form.
To find out how and where the brain handles improvisation, Aaron Berkowitz scanned the brains of jazz musicians using an MRI scanner. They were given an electronic keyboard and varied amounts of musical freedom, starting from playing a set tune to a straight beat, up to being allowed to do as they pleased.
And we came up with three regions there that were involved: the dorsal premotor cortex, the anterior cingulate cortex, and the inferior frontal gyrus. Now, what does that mean? The dorsal premotor cortex is an area of the brain that's involved in planning movements. So this is an area that will sort of come up with a motor plan, and then it sends its information right next door to the motor cortex. And the motor cortex, those cells, the axons, go actually all the way down the spinal cord, connect to one other neuron that will go out to the muscles. The more freedom the improvisers had, the more this area was active, suggesting that there was some more motor planning going on. The anterior cingulate cortex is involved in a whole range of cognitive tasks. Some people think it monitors the possibility for conflict between possibilities. The improviser is sort of at any moment has an infinite number of musical possibilities to choose from. So this area may be involved in sort of monitoring what the possibilities are and making a decision. And then perhaps the most exciting was seeing this area, the inferior frontal gyrus. This is an area that's well known to be involved in language perception as well as in speech. It's part of what's called Broca's area, after the French neurologist Paul Broca. And this is an area that's commonly affected in stroke. And people that have strokes that affect this area, they're able to understand language, but they have a lot of trouble speaking, might be unable to produce words while they still can understand words. What was interesting to us is that this area is involved in musical improvisation. Now, there had been a previous study of pianists playing Bach and comparing that to them playing scales. And this area did not seem to be more active when they were playing Bach. And Bach is obviously very complex musically. So it suggests that this area is not just involved because the improvisations in our study were more complex than the patterns, but it has something to do with the improvising. And if we relate that to the role in language, it suggests that this area is involved in sequencing motor actions, sound sequences in real time, whether those actions and sounds are linguistic or musical. So it suggests a more general role for this area, not just in language, but in sort of generativity, more broadly defined, whether that's linguistic, musical, or sort of moving with gestures.
Aaron and his colleagues then did a follow-up study which found musicians can shut down some brain activity when they're improvising more successfully than non-musicians.
And interestingly, those three regions I mentioned earlier don't differ in activity between the two groups. The only difference is that the musicians seem to deactivate an area of the brain called the right temporoparietal junction towards the back of the brain. It's an area involved in attention. This was kind of an unexpected and interesting finding. We were expecting differences in the sort of areas involved in generativity or spontaneity or maybe auditory areas, thinking the musicians would be monitoring their sort of output for musical quality. But we didn't expect to see this region involved, so we looked into what other sort of contexts it's deactivated in, and it seems to be deactivated in states of sustained goal-directed attention. So it's possible that musical training, or improvisation in particular, allows musicians to go into a special sort of attentional state where their focus is more intent on what's happening, and they'd sort of tune out anything that could distract them from that.
Do you feel that there are limits to studying brain activity in terms of what it can actually tell us about human creativity? Because lying in an MRI scanner holding onto a small keyboard is a world away from playing an improvisation to a large audience at Carnegie Hall, for example.
It sure is, on many levels. Not just that our improvisers were told not to move their head more than a millimeter and only had five piano keys to play with, and that piano keyboard was resting on their lap with their hands sticking out of the scanner, which at the same time was making a lot of noise. This is not a smoky, ambient jazz club.
As luck would have it, though, around the same time Aaron did his work, a team at Johns Hopkins University, led by Dr. Charles Lim, had a similar idea, and the two studies were published within months of each other.
They had jazz musicians improvising over a chordal background. Now, given they were still lying down in a brain scanner, for sure, and told not to move very much. But the interesting thing there is they saw, I believe it was over 40 areas active, whereas when we did our conjunction analysis I told you about, we only saw three. So they clearly got more of a full range of what happens when people are improvising. They had areas involved in emotion, areas involved in hearing and sound interpretation. But then the challenge is interpreting that. Which of these areas are involved because of improvisation precisely as opposed to the emotional component itself? So one takes different degrees of strategy and tries to look at how we can isolate something but still keep true to what we're looking at. That's a constant balancing act.
But for Ross Band, deconstructing improvisation is inherently problematic, not just because it's like riding a bike. If you think about it too much, you'll fall off, but also because the music itself resists capture and analysis.
I think in the West we do compartmentalise these things. And I feel like the creativity is actually suppressed if one starts to be... So that's like being self-conscious. My feeling is that the whole thing is you're out of your consciousness. You're in the mode of the manner of operation of creating sound that is fully endorsing every one of your human processes. And the kinds of synapses and the neurological and physiological impulses that we're having are so connected down the spine, and they're happening so fast that we can't really be clever enough to really be sitting in the box seat. That all happens, and I would contend that if you're sitting and watching yourself, you're not fully present. It's always so fully on to the sound of the present that one doesn't have time for any of that. The critical domain. A lot of what we do as improvisers is just in the air for now, and that's the beauty of it, the present moment, and that we're not trying to freeze it. There's a couple of improvisations on the Yusoboe CD where I'm working with a koto player. Neither of us can know what's in each other's mind. We're just making sure we're in tune with all of our billions of plucked strings before. But then we go, and I said something about the sun goddess, and we're two women in a room with wonderful skill, and it was the shining light of the sun, you know? There's some magic that can be absolutely got in the real-time now moment. And for me, that is the best of improvisation, and that is the best of composition as well.
That experience is sort of correlate what we see going on in the brain, not surprisingly, that musicians that describe what they feel when they're improvising and how the experience correlates with the areas we see in the brain. There's this wonderful quote by one of the sort of fathers or grandfathers of music cognition, Robert Francaise, where he says, "This research only comes to reveal the truths that musicians already themselves knew. What we've uncovered in the brain, improvisers could have told us." This sort of resonated a little bit with my own experience at performing, that that type of brain processing just is not really valid. It's not going to be helpful. One has to really go from note to note, and the performances I've had that I've been most happy with and felt the best about, and I think that the audiences have also appreciated the most, are ones where one does get into this state where one is steering gently from the background and hoping not to get too involved, that all of that practice has become automatic, but not in a mechanistic sense, that the basic processes, the riding of the bike, the pedaling and the balance, one doesn't need to worry about falling off. One can just sort of look ahead at the view and enjoy the wind.
Neuroscientist and musician Dr. Aaron Berkowitz speaking there to producer Corinne Podger, and his book is called The Improvising Mind, Cognition and Creativity in the Musical Moment, published by Oxford University Press. And Tony Gould is currently writing a book about improv too. Oodles of food for thought, don't you reckon? Relevant to all of us, this question of what allows us to play intellectually without judgment. So my question is, are you an improviser? Have you ever tried to explain what's going on in your head when you do improvise? What do you like about seeing other people improvise musically? Would really love your thoughts. Post them on our website. More info, the audio and transcript there too, abc.net.au/rn/allinthemind. Thanks to sound engineer Tim Simons. I'm Natasha Mitchell. Catch you next week.